Hollywood is rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Hello, 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 and welcome to Rated LGBT Radio and this installment of our podcast. And yes, I am your host, Rob Watson. We pride ourselves on presenting some of the first peeks at great films, streaming shows. Last week we had Chaz Bono with his film, Bury the Bride, which was a horror movie, is a horror movie. We had The Warrior Nuns, which is streaming on Netflix. We've had lots of great shows that have been, or great movies that have been in the film festival circuit that would, you know, are slowly making their way to mainstream streaming. Well, today we have a film project that you cannot go check out anywhere because the film is still in production. It is at the very beginning stages. And so we're letting you have a sneak peek of something yet to come. It is a film that will be called Scraps. And best way I can describe it is that if the series Heartstopper was set in Montana and around skateboards and an artist, you would be in the right genre of what Scraps is going to be about. We have the two filmmakers who both wrote the film and one is directing the film. Ryan Norton is the director and one of the producers, and Matthew Francis is the other producer and co-writer of the scripts. And I say scripts because there is a short film version and a long form full feature version that have been written. Both of them are excellent. So we are going to talk to them about the film they are planning to make and give you an insight into that whole thought process. But first, I want to pivot over to the editor of the Los Angeles Blade and co-host of the show, Brody Levesque, to find out what is new and happening in our world. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon, Rob, and good afternoon to all of our listeners. Before I start reading through some of the headlines and stories that we're following in our newsroom, I wanted to, at the urging of the health departments for the city of New York, the city of Chicago, and Los Angeles County, all three health departments are asking that people who are at a higher risk for Mpox, which is also referred to as monkeypox, to get fully vaccinated. If you haven't been with two doses of the vaccine, there have been only three confirmed cases, for example, in Los Angeles, but there has been a reported cluster of at least 14 in Chicago and about the same in New York. So for those of you that would like to protect yourselves, please do. The following groups are considered at higher risk for contracting Mpox. That's any man or transgender person who has sex with men or trans persons. These are persons of any gender or sexual orientation who engage in commercial or transactional sex or have sex in association with large public events. People that are living with HIV, especially people with uncontrolled or advanced HIV, and sexual partners of any of the folks in the people above. So if you fall into those categories, the health department and health officers for the city and county of Los Angeles, Cook County and the city of Chicago, and New York and the county of New York ask that you please, please, please go get vaccinated. So let's talk about the news. It's not good, of course. That's normal, but that's what we get up with. Currently, the things that we're watching, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis today signed the first of many bills that is basically going to allow doctors and physicians and insurance companies to refuse anybody that's LGBTQ+. So it's not just trans folks, it's basically everybody, and they can do it predicated on religious beliefs and other things. So that bill is now law in Florida. The governor signed it a few hours ago. We haven't gotten any feedback yet from Equality Florida, and I'm waiting on that, but I'm sure that Brandon and the crew there will let me know. The other thing that's very, very troubling about Florida, in addition to the pile-on, is that based on another bill that is sitting on DeSantis's desk, which probably will be signed, this is Senate Bill 254. This particular bill, and this is based on the research that we've done, our journalist and columnist contributor Aaron Reed has done a lot of work on this. From her research, it's determining that this new Florida law will probably disrupt about 80% of transgender folks across the state. This is beyond the young people now. This is everybody. So you're looking at about 80% of the trans patients in Florida losing access to gender-affirming care. For some, that's a pretty big deal because there are transgender individuals. I actually know two of them personally myself who live in Melbourne that transitioned years ago, but they still continue their regimen. This will now make it virtually impossible to do that, so it's going to turn into a thing. I've been told by my sources at NCLR, Lambda Legal, and ACLU that this is going to be a contained part of a lawsuit against the state of Florida. Once we get an injunction from a federal judge, will be helpful. But again, this puts a lot of people at risk. So there's the Florida debacle. Moving across the U.S., let's talk about drag bans because we're still putting up with that. As we enter into Pride season, we now have prides that are either canceling out the Pride parade completely or they are limiting the Pride festivals to 21 and up with government IDs. And in the case of the folks down in Northwest Arkansas, the entire Pride event, okay, was forced to relocate from the festival because the Walton Center in Fayetteville, which is where it's normally held, said, nope, can't do it, too big of a liability. Mind you, the law that was just passed and signed by Governor Huckabee Sanders does not include drag performances. But because the wording of the bill is so vague, a lot of these entities, like the Walton Center, which is run by a nonprofit for the city of Fayetteville, the board decided it was too much a risk, and they basically told Northwest Arkansas Equality, who runs the Pride, sorry, you know, no Pride this year for you at our facility. So that Pride, I'd say conservatively, gets probably between 5,000 to 10,000 people from that part of Arkansas and that part of the region around it every year in attendance. So it has significant impact. And it has detrimental effects, obviously, on the community. So at this point, they're doing a scramble to find another venue. We hope they succeed. Let's bounce a state up to Missouri. Missouri's legislature just sent two bills to the governor for signature. Both of these bills not only restricts trans residents' access to health care, but it also prohibits them from school sports. If they're, you know, young folk. Shira Berkowitz, who's the senior public policy director for Promo Missouri, which is the statewide LGBT organization, told the Los Angeles Blade, and I quote, "It's an incredibly devastating day for transgender Missourians and for families raising transgender youth and for all of Missouri." Senate Bill 39 will ban all trans student athletes from kindergarten through college being able to play on sports as sanctioned on school teams that would align with their gender identity. And it applies to all schools in the state. So that means public, private, and charter schools. The other bill that was sent is Senate Bill 49. This one bans gender-affirming surgery for anyone under 18, along with access to transgender-affirming care for minors who are already non- or prescribed path for health care. And then additionally, under the law, Medicaid will no longer be able to cover gender-affirming health care for children or adults, and people who are incarcerated will no longer have access to any gender-affirming care at all whatsoever while they are in state custody. We have a person in St. Louis. He's a rabbi, Daniel Bogart. I've spoken to Rabbi Danny several times. The rabbi has a trans son, and he's been extremely, very, very active in advocacy against the state's anti-trans legislation. In a tweet yesterday, Rabbi Danny said this: "I hate them so much, and I hate that I hate them. May the grandchildren of the Republican politicians passing these bigoted bills grow up to be ashamed of who their grandparents were. Yamash Shimon, protect trans kids." I think that Rabbi Danny's sentiments pretty much echo, you know, what we're hearing, not just in Missouri, but across the United States. A friend of the show, someone who's been on a couple times, a person that's probably referred to as a Brody brat, Landon Ritchie, who is with Tent in Texas, which is a trans advocacy group. He's also with Texas, Equality Texas and the Gender Cool Project. They're currently fighting Senate Bill 14, which would essentially do the same thing that Missouri's just did and that, you know, Florida's did and everybody else. So it's become a pile-on. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's two things I'd like our listeners to remember. Number one, these are Republicans that are doing this. Number two, the vast majority of them are cisgender white men. And number three, they're attacking children. They are attacking children. This is about, you know, erasure, not only just of our community with the book bans and the stupid don't say gay laws, but these attacks on these trans kids are an attempt to erase the very existence of these children. These are people who are attacking children. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This is a craven effort, okay, by these people, all right, to destroy not only just that part of our community, but our community in general. You know, I cannot emphasize enough that if you have the ability, you know, the LGBT organizations on the ground in these states desperately need your help. Volunteer, sign up, protest, donate, whatever it takes. You know, people like my friend Danny, Rabbi Danny in St. Louis will thank you. You know, his trans kid will thank you. My young friend Landon will thank you. Our dear friends in Florida, at Equality Florida, will thank you. But most importantly, okay, this is something that we can do for our community. And the last bit of news I'm going to throw to you, Rob, because you wrote about this. It's number one at the Los Angeles Blade. It's tracking and trending. The drag community got together, and they had themselves a telethon, and it was hugely successful. It continues to be successful. And again, it's highly trafficked at the Los Angeles Blade, but I'll let you tell our listeners about it.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah, I would expand, even though you're absolutely right, the epicenter of these targets is children, both trans kids and gay kids. You know, it's like the don't say gay laws are meant to have erasure in schools that gay people even exist. And as you look at gay people's stories coming out, especially back a few decades ago, one of the issues was when I grew up, I saw no one like me. I didn't know other people existed. Now, our society has progressed since then, so if they're paying attention pretty much anywhere else, online, on TV, et cetera, you know, we obviously do exist. So it's not at that level, but that is the attempt. But beyond that, it is also the parents of trans kids. Having a kid who their potential of you doing nothing means that they're more likely to suicide, and I'm speaking as a parent, that is being designated to hell, to be put in a place where you are supposedly allowed to do absolutely nothing to advocate for your child and help your child and give them a fully healthy, normal life, both physical health and mental health. So, yeah, these people are renegades. They're awful. They're fascists, quite frankly. And they may call themselves Republicans, but very quickly the Republican Party is becoming the fascist party. And also, you know, speaking to the article, and drag isn't dangerous, The other thing that is under siege is our creative expression. Drag is obviously a legacy creative expression for the LGBTQ community, and it is highly under attack for absolutely no good reason whatsoever. And these artists are being targeted. In the article and from the telethon, Nina West tells a story about how in her doing readings at libraries, et cetera, and doing a tour, she has been targeted and persecuted by these right-wing extremists, threatening her family, you know, outside her house. You know, it is serious, folks. And the telethon itself is meant to raise money for the ACLU. And if you read the article, you can find the links in it to donate. The telethon aimed to reach $250,000. It maxed over $500,000 in raising just in the telethon time alone. And I don't know what the current total is, but if you want to add to it, please do check out the article. So stepping away from the news of the day, I want to go back to the theme of our show, and that is two young filmmakers with a film that is written and ready to go in terms of its future production. So with that, I'd like to welcome onto the show Matthew and Ryan. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us on.
Oh, thanks for joining us. It's going great. Now, Matthew, you both come from Minnesota, and Ryan, I think you are now located in Montana. Is that right?
I spend my time between Montana and Los Angeles, and I'm currently in L.A. right now.
Both
of us are from Minnesota.
Yeah, we're both from the small little lakeside town of Duluth, Minnesota, and beautiful town.
Beautiful, yeah. Ryan, I did want to just check in with you on what's going on in Montana, because it's been actually a hotbed of controversy over the transgender issues. Do you have any observations on the ground in Montana of what the mood is there?
I haven't been there since the Zoe Zephyr, everything that went down there, but I know that the political landscape there has definitely been in a very difficult place since that has happened. And I know my experience there, I definitely felt some of the pressure of that. I know they painted some pride sidewalks in Bozeman, and, you know, cars freaked their tires over them. And so it definitely doesn't feel like the safest place to be someone who's queer. And
So interestingly, the film Scraps is going to take place in Montana. Were you led to do that because the environment is a little bit unsafe, or what was your bent on setting the film in that environment?
For me, the film definitely came from my experiences of growing up from ages of from 18 to 23 in Montana, and sort of my experience coming out there. And I had a really positive experience, and I think it's easy for people who maybe haven't visited the state to see it as a very dark place. And I don't want to spread that message, because I think there is a lot of great things happening in Montana, and I really want people to see that. And I had an amazing experience being queer there, and there obviously were some difficulties, but I think that we're trying to tell the unauthentic story of how that was.
Well, yeah, and there is obviously a positive story from Montana too, because just on what you mentioned with Zoe, there was, even though in the state government itself, she was highly persecuted, she stepped outside, and you know, a lot of support showed up at the doorstep there. So, yeah, so there's obviously good heart somewhere there, and that's really who we want to reach. I want to backtrack, though. You both have pretty impressive video backgrounds. You have worked with Samsung, Oakley, Hyundai, ESPN, and Matthew. And Matthew, I have to say, I have a special place in my heart for you coming from foodie and film, because those are two things I love. I am definitely addicted to the Food Channel in a big way. How did you each get started in your film interests?
Ryan,
yeah,
first.
I can talk first. For me, it was really, you know, started out in high school. I started the film club at East High School in Duluth and wanted to get, you know, other kids excited about filmmaking like I was. And I ultimately just started making little short films for the talent show. And, that was kind of, you know, the early beginnings of film for me. And I moved out to Montana and met a small group of filmmakers there and started doing real estate videos. And that quickly turned into commercial film production and then some documentary work, you know, getting into tourism and telling more local stories around the state of Montana and in Minnesota. And then started to transition a little bit into narrative and where we are now. And I felt like I really wanted to change from the commercial side of things and wanted to put some more passion and heart into the work that I was creating.
How about you, Matthew?
Yeah, for me, so, you know, grew up in Duluth, and Ryan was on the east side of town. I was on the west side. I went to Denfeld High School, and growing up, I loved food, and I loved, like, food TV. I was the kind of food nerd who would sit around and watch Food Network and Cooking Channel all day long and take notes. And so I always knew I wanted to be a chef, but I didn't know – I didn't even know, like, making films or being on TV or making TV was a job as a kid for some reason. So my only path forward in my mind was becoming a chef. So I went to culinary school for 4 years. I worked in restaurants all around the country, and I competed in, like, cooking competitions to raise money for college. And then basically I kind of fell in love, like, even deeper with film and with editing and kind of visual storytelling when YouTube became a thing. You know, I was, like, watching YouTubers both for food and comedy and stories. And so in college, I started making dumb little food videos with my friends. And those kind of I didn't get any views, maybe 10 views per video. But eventually, by the time I graduated culinary school, BuzzFeed had seen them. So they sent me an email and they said, hey, we have a new food brand called Tasty, and we're looking for a young chef who we can bring on to teach about video and become one of our producers. And I was like, whoa, like, sure, I'd love to come over. And this is right when, like, Facebook video was just being invented. So social media was barely a thing at the time, especially social media with video. And at the time, BuzzFeed Tasty was making, like, pizza dip and, like, you know, pickle rolls, but nothing really chefy. So that's why they wanted to hire me. And so right after culinary school, I moved to Los Angeles, and I was a Tasty producer for, like, 2.5 years. I feel like it's like free film school. I got to learn from incredibly passionate, talented people who went to film school, who had been working in TV, in media, in all different aspects for so long. And I got to create some viral food videos. And the whole time, you know, I took my chef expertise and was learning about video and how to film and edit. But I also want to tell more stories, because we could with food, you know, with, like, kind of personal family stories or kind of cultural stories, but not really to the same narrative level that I was kind of was hoping for. And I'm a big reader. I love watching movies. And so I knew one day maybe I could possibly, you know, keep doing food, but transition to a more narrative thing. And then since BuzzFeed, you know, I freelanced other companies like Viacom and Fox and MTV, other little places. And then now I work at Dotdash Meredith, which is a huge media conglomerate that owns kind of all the big magazine brands that have been turned to digital. So Better Homes and Gardens, People, Entertainment Weekly. And then for the food side where I work on, there's Food and Wine, Eating Well, All Recipes, Southern Living. You know, basically all those beautiful food magazines are now digital. And I lead a food and film crew. We shoot 20 recipe videos every week for any of those food brands. And it's balls to the wall every single day, but it's beautiful. I get to kind of combine my loves of food and filming together. But how I got into writing was, you know, as a kid, I was on my high school speech team, and I was in the category of storytelling, and then we'd go and perform at little local high schools in Minnesota and perform in front of other students. So I got in the habit of writing a story on the fly and how to really tell a good narrative from beginning to end, how to add heart in a really quick little thing. I had to write a lot of essays for college to get money for tuition. And then during the pandemic, when everything kind of shut down, I decided I had a story in my head for a novel. So I wrote my first YA queer sci-fi action novel called Prax and the Hazard of Countdown. And that was my first experience writing a full story outside of like my work and outside of school. And I love it. I'm really proud of it. And I knew I wanted more. And so that's where Ryan and I first kind of became connected, because early last year, I had seen, his photography and cinematic work was shared on like a Duluth Instagram page. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, like I'm a young kind of video producer and from Duluth, and I want to make films one day. My goal is to write my first short film this year. What are you working on? And Ryan was like, I want to direct my first short film. And that's where Scraps started. We both wrote the screenplay. I would say like we had different like jobs within it, everyone's loving the story, and now we're set to make the short film. So we're really, really proud where we're going.
Excellent. Yeah. And Ryan, as Matthew said, he kind of made contact and with the goal of writing, the story is actually based on your life. Is that correct?
Yeah, largely based on, you know, my experiences coming out in Montana to a group of friends there, and also my time growing up in Minnesota, and largely based on kind of my experience dabbling in the skateboarding world a little bit. I kind of have these memories of, you know, walking into a Zoomies and buying my first skateboard. I think this is when I was like 12 or 13. And kind of setting it down in a skate park and just immediately feeling such a taboo, like I didn't belong there. That wasn't a place for me. Hmm. And I remember too, like buying a pair of these like Etnies flat bottom skate shoes and wearing them into one of my middle school classes and just getting laughed at because I didn't feel like I could really be this person who I was interested in being. And, so I had a lot of resistance to the skateboarding world, and I think I started getting into longboarding a lot more because that was something I could do on my own time outside of the skate park, and felt a little bit more comfortable doing that. I really knew that for my first feature film, I wanted to tell this passionate coming-of-age story that was largely based on my life and that experience, but then also dramatize that a little bit, make it a more interesting arc and develop some really rich characters that could help tell a better story. And so the initial project started out actually as a novel, and I began writing 4 or 5 chapters of that novel. Just starting to develop the characters and the setting, and around that time I also met Matthew, and I started telling about the project, and we really hit it off right away. And I think one thing that's funny that Matthew said is I actually think we might have met on Hinge. So if he's listening here, that'll be great.
Yeah.
I think
friendship's better.
Connected on there, and. We weren't interested in a romantic sense, but we still wanted to connect and work together. And it became a really beautiful friendship and partnership, and we started hopping on calls almost every day, brainstorming what this movie could turn into and what it could be. And it started to get a lot of buzz recently, and a lot of young actors have been talking about it, and it's been really exciting for us to see this journey unfold.
Yeah, it sounds great, and it's intriguing. It's funny, I relate to it on a whole separate level because my son, who is 20, actually works at Zumiez. He is a skateboarder, and he would relate to a lot of the things in the films because he literally has built a skateboard from scraps, and
hell yeah,
one on his own. So he would have protected you at the park. He's not gay himself, but you know, obviously the son of a gay dad, you know, he's very protective of those who are. So I feel like he's going to be very intrigued by the story. Now, so there are two scripts. There's a long full feature film length script and a short film script. They both kind of end a little bit differently. What is the strategy behind the two scripts?
So basically, one thing that we did when we first started writing was we realized that we had a larger story to tell. And even though our initial goal was to only write a short film, we're like, man, we really have a lot larger of a story here. So we decided to follow our passions and fully finish the feature length version of the story. And we are really proud of the larger story. But then we have to, in order to kind of get funding, often you have to do a proof of concept or a smaller short film version first. So once we had the full story with all the characters, all the ups and downs, the full journey, we were able to take some of the best scenes that kind of got you a small taste of that larger tale, and we made it in the short film version. And that way we can shoot it within a few days. We can make a really beautiful, smaller version of the product and then get more people on board for the feature. But both stories are self-contained. They're both really beautiful, and they're just extensions of each other.
Yeah, and I want to give you kudos. Number one, both scripts are very well written. It's top notch. And I've read plenty of scripts, trust me. And, it's like I hate the ones where I'm like cringing through. These are well drawn, very natural, very relatable. The second is, I think, and Ryan, I think this was your influence that I was reading about, but a lot of what your influence is independent films from Europe. And the reason that speaks to me is because I've always had kind of a problem with some of the independent American gay LGBT films that they too often try to make statements about, this is what a gay person thinks or this is what a gay person does, rather than tell the stories of characters who happen to be gay. And your scripts are very organic that way. These are definite characters. Their attraction and their feelings for each other are obviously gay, but they're not trying to make themselves a trope or a prototype of what it takes to be a gay person in America or Montana specifically. Can you talk a little bit about your influences of existing LGBTQ films and how that either influenced you or things that you didn't want it to become?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, from the onset, I am a huge lover of queer cinema, and I've just been an avid consumer of a lot of those films. And it's funny, on my Letterboxd, I have a whole list of kind of my favorite LGBTQ films. And I definitely wanted, the influence of this film to be avant-garde. I look at films like Beach Rats, films like Youngins or Boys, which was Misha Camp's directorial debut. Like you're saying, some of these foreign films that I felt like were telling a really authentic story. And I also went and recently saw the film Joyland and Close, which were two of this year's Oscar foreign films. And I was deeply affected by that, especially Lucas Daunt's Close, where, just the story of these two boys kind of figuring out how
you know, what this kind of early love is in a male friendship and how that kind of bleeds away as you get older. And so those were definitely big influences for me with this film. And I think, too, like, there's obviously some bigger queer films that Matthew and I both reference, like Call Me By Your Name and Brokeback and some of these classics. Yeah, ultimately, I think we were trying to stray away from the Love, Simon, Love, Victor kind mm-hmm. of narrative and keep it a little bit more personal.
Yeah, our film is like a time capsule type of movie. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead. And can you elaborate on that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so,
yeah.
You know, we love... Oh, Ryan, you go.
Well, I was just saying... yeah, trying to make this film about skateboarding. Obviously, it is about the queer experience as well, but trying to have the characters be first in this narrative. And it is a coming-out story, but it isn't a coming-out story like I think most people have seen or experienced before. If you want to elaborate that on that, Matthew, too.
Yeah. Basically, what I was going to say is, so this is like a time capsule of a movie, right? It's not taking place in modern times. It's in 2003, which I know it seems pretty recent, and it is, but now it's 20 years ago. And especially talking about a smaller town like Livingston, Montana, you know, there's a different attitude that you may see in like on the coastal sides of the U.S. And I think a lot of our queer stories come from their more like liberal towns, and it's in a more modern sensibility. But with this story, we really want to take you back to a time where it was before the internet, before everyone was on their phones all the time, and where like people really had to figure out who they were first before they could see themselves on TV or in other shows. And that's why I think it feels really real to you, Rob, because before we could just have Bridger or Gus just be gay, or what we've seen before many times, these people had to be real individuals who had a real thing that was happening to them this summer, and they just met. They happened to meet. They happened to become friends first, and then that friendship developed over time because they were both having pulls and dreams and wants between each other, and they each had something they wanted to accomplish. You know, Bridger wants to become a better skater, but he's also kind of lost. He wants to figure out some purpose in his life. And then Gus, he is going to art school, but he is like kind of have no friends, and he doesn't know how to kind of live within the world around him. He's kind of stuck in his sketchbook. So both these boys have a personal journey to go on. It's not just about them being gay. It's not just about the love or the romance. Those things come, but it's all about their personal growth from the beginning of that summer to the end. And I think everyone has a summer of their life where they really transform and change and grow. And we wanted to reflect that more human experience beyond just the gay part of the story, because that's what's most relatable to everybody, and it's what's most beautiful. And then the gay part of the story is what can add that cherry on the top that makes it even more unique, niche, and profound. But yeah, it's about Bridger, Gus, and their story together.
Well, also, I think one of the aspects of it, and you know, in the promo for this podcast, I referenced Heartstoppers because both feature not really gay sex, but gay romance. And I think that's an important coming out, honestly, because a lot of the rhetoric that we've talked about at the top of the show, a lot of this political persecution that's happening, part of the leverage that they are using to scare people, conservative people who are not that well versed with what gay people are and everything else, is they are trying to make it all about sex, and they don't, one of the perspectives they don't have, for example, in kindergarten, they have no problem with a little girl walking to kindergarten, and they tell her story of Cinderella and falling in love with a prince, and, you know, so heterosexuality is ingrained, and, you know, to, that influence is there, but, you know, they don't see same-sex attraction as romantic. So the right. romance aspect of your story, I think, is actually super important, because I think for people who aren't gay, I think they do need to see and experience that. So I think that's super, super vital. One thing we haven't talked about, which people listening just have no idea, can you give us a little teaser on the plot itself so people know what the film is about, how it evolves?
Yeah. Should I take that one, Ryan?
Yeah, go for it. Or how about I'll read the log line and then you can maybe dive into
Perfect.
It a little bit more so
Perfect.
We can keep it alive. But yeah, the log line of Scraps is in rural 2003 Montana, two closeted teen boys navigate unexpected love and harsh small town judgment while selling handcrafted boards to a gang of Livingston skaters.
Yes. So basically our story starts off where we have a young 18-year-old boy named Gus. He's shy, he's artistic, but he doesn't really know a lot about the world because he's only from a small town in Minnesota. And he is going to art school for the first time across the country in Rhode Island, once the summer is over. But he has to save some money up to pay for college. So his uncle lives in Montana, and his uncle gave him a job working in his wood shop. So Gus comes to Montana. He's a new kid in town. He's kind of more like his uncle lives outside of the major city, kind of in a more kind of rural area. And Gus works for his uncle, making some money, making chairs, some furniture. And over time, he wants to explore the town a bit. So he goes into Livingston, and then all of a sudden, he like sees the sights, and then he stumbles across like a skate park, and he sees boys skateboarding, doing really cool tricks, flying high in the air for the first time. And you know, this is the time kind of before internet, so maybe he's heard of skateboarding but never seen it in his actual, right in front of him before. So Gus is like amazed by skateboarding, and in particular, he finds one boy interestingly more fascinating than the rest. And Gus is someone who always is like skating, like the nature around it, or he's sketching the nature around him, and he kind of sketches the park, and he really finds a beautiful a fascination with skateboarding. But then he doesn't have a skateboard. He doesn't know how to do it himself. He has no money to buy the tools for it. So he goes and tells his uncle, and the uncle is like, not for it. He's like, you have to keep working, save your money. None of us have been to college before. This is your chance to make something of yourself. You should go to college and focus on your actual work. But Gus sneaks out. He goes to a skate shop in town. He tries to figure out that he can't afford it, so he has to like make one himself. He ends up stealing some wood scraps from his uncle without telling him, and he starts making a skateboard himself. Eventually, he makes it. He goes to practice alone at the park because he tried earlier to maybe talk to some people where he meets Tara, but then he hears the skateboarding boys kind of joking around, and one of them named Max is like a bully, and he's kind of homophobic and really aggressive, and that scares Gus away from wanting to go meet them because Gus has never been able to make friends. And then he eventually, once all the boys leave, he skateboards on his own, falls over a bunch of times, and then he meets Bridger, who like forgot his MP3 player on the bench. The boys strike up conversation. Bridger's wowed by this board, and basically they make a deal where Bridger will teach Gus how to skate if Gus can make Bridger a homemade board. And that's where their connection begins. So the boys, Bridger starts teaching Gus how to skate. Gus sneaks Bridger into the wood shop to show him how he made the board. And they develop a friendship over this kind of deal as time goes on. And they realize they make each other laugh. They can tell each other secrets they've never told anyone else before. They reminisce about their lives, both in small towns, and their dreams for the future. And they really get deeper and closer. But, you know, Max, or Bridger has all these kind of boys in town that he's used to hanging out with who wouldn't freak out if any kind of gay stuff happened or any kind of feelings of romance toward another boy. So Bridger is kind of lost in his thoughts about things, and Gus doesn't know how he can keep this up without his uncle finding out about him taking the materials. And as time goes on, both boys really kind of are facing pushes and pulls from people around them that makes their own growing friendship and eventual relationship much more difficult. There's a bonfire night, the boys get pretty close, they have an almost kiss, and their friendship really becomes something more serious. And we have other characters like Tara Shea, who is another character in town, who befriends Gus, and she notices that he's different than the other boys around them, and she kind of brings out the softer side of Gus and accepts him for who he is, and that allows Gus to kind of start flourishing. And as time goes on, the boys try to they get more confidence in their making of the board. They try to sell them to people around town. And eventually the choice that kind of comes apparent is they have to either be honest with everyone around them or they have to keep hiding. And leave it to actually watching the film to see what happens. But It's a beautiful summer where both boys learn a lot about each other, their small town, and the future they hope to build.
Right. Wonderful. And so, Ryan, since this is based on your story, which of the characters is more you?
Definitely. I think that I definitely, like, put myself into both Gus and Bridger. Gus, from an artistic side, growing up, I was that creative type. I felt like I maybe would have wanted to build my own skateboard, and that kind of could have been my, like, creative way of fitting in. And, yeah, being shy, kind of being an artist, not really having a lot of friends growing up, and maybe, you know, one or two really close connections, but no, I didn't have this huge friend circle. And so I think that I really related to Gus in that aspect, but I also related to Bridger in a couple different ways where I, you know, as I was growing up in Montana, felt like I had a really interesting experience coming out to my friends there. And there's a scene in the movie where he comes out to his friends in this pond, I guess. They're swimming in a pond, and they keep asking him, like, who's the girl? Who's the girl? Because they know that he, you know, has been seeing someone or has been hanging out with someone. And that line, who's the girl, is real for my life, where, you know, my friends found out that I went on a date, and they kept asking me, like, yeah, who is this girl that you were hanging out with last night? And eventually it's like, well, not a girl. you know, it's a guy. And so I think that really influenced Bridger, and I'm so glad that that scene is in the movie because it hits close to home for me.
That's awesome. What was the process for the two of you writing together? How did you integrate, especially since, Ryan, it was your, you know, a lot of your experience, but then Matthew obviously is the talented writer as well.
Yeah, I think, well, it really started out us just getting all of our ideas and some of these lines from, you know, real life experiences from my life, like, down in a Google Doc. And we ended up making a 30-page document that just had all of the characters and scenes from, you know, my life and, you know, some of the writings from the novel that I started. And Matthew was able to come in and build some other characters, like Tara Shea, who is actually a character that we both kind of had in our lives. And I think we thought was really important to the script. And once we got that 30-page kind of outline, Matthew was able to really, like, come in strong and help bust out a first draft. And then together we would come back and work through the dialogue and shave things here and there, and all while kind of reading the script out loud together, over Zoom calls just constantly, and me, you know, playing Bridger and Matthew playing Gus, and us both reading the action lines and saying, like, you know, maybe that's not realistic. And and we individually did write different scenes here and there. I would say Matthew did the bulk of the writing overall. And then it was just, yeah, back and forth of refining it. And Matthew, if you want to touch on that at all.
Yeah, so I think it's really fascinating about the process that Ryan and I did, because I've worked with other writers in the past, and we have a really complementary writing style, where basically, you know, as Ryan said, we kind of made this huge document, and he had a lot of, like, visual ideas for the film and a lot of beautiful, like, scene ideas and line ideas, but he didn't really know how to connect from A to Z, right? And where I come in with writing is I love structure. I love how do we get from the beginning to the middle to the end and create a lot of beautiful arcs within the meantime. So I was able, our usual process was he would give some ideas, and then, like, I put in a few things of my own, right? So like the character of Tara Shea, I have an actual friend named Tara in my real life who's given permission for us to use the name. And, you know, she inspired me a lot and really helped me come out when I was growing up. So Tara is fully influenced from this woman in my life. And as Ryan said, he had a Tara in his own life, who's also a friend of mine. And it's so funny how life works sometimes. But and then basically how it would work is I would write, because I'm really good at like kind of word vomiting on a page where I can write a huge, a large amount of stuff and let all the ideas flow out, Glee, and what would you actually say in real life? And so what I would do is like, I'd have a little meeting with Ryan, and then I'd do like a huge chunk of writing where like for 2 days I would kind of, you know, make like maybe three or four scenes. And then we'd come to Ryan and I'd come back to Ryan and we'd kind of pare it down a little bit. And that kind of push and pull allowed us really to create the first draft so quickly and really, I think, continue honing it, because if it were just me, I probably would have made it much too long or maybe too in-depth. So Ryan kind of pulling it back allowed it to feel more grounded and more real and more, of course, to his vision of the story. But then maybe if I hadn't been involved, Ryan would have had a lot of great ideas that maybe wouldn't have gotten across the finish line, because we're both really busy people, and I kind of just have this way to like push to actually get to the heart of the story and move forward. So yeah, our how it happened is we have very complementary but very different writing styles, which was really great for the project.
Yeah,
Matt, that's very cool.
Overnight, if he needed to, and then my style is I'm a lot more focused on like the individual words and going a lot slower with it. So it'd be hard for me to write as quickly as Matthew could. And so, yeah, that was definitely a fun back and forth.
Yeah, for sure. So, guys, I want to ask you, what is the process moving forward? Because obviously you've got to, now your producer hats have got to go on and you've got to, get the funding and, all of that stuff together. What is the process and who do you have involved on that?
Absolutely. We've managed to attach a couple producers who have been absolutely critical to the project thus far, and one of them is Chance Housley, who's a Montana-based producer, and he's been there from day one, really getting a lot of the background work done that you don't see. And another person who's been absolutely influential is Colton Underwood, who was on The Bachelor and in the NFL, and he came onto the project several months ago and has been really, really helpful in getting the script passed around Hollywood. And so meeting him was definitely a game changer for Scraps.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, then on a more insular level, like we won a grant the Big Sky Film Grant for that was our first win, and we currently have a Kickstarter that's running right now. It's about to end, and we kind of raised money through both the grant and through the fundraising and with some private donors, and that's where we will move forward with making the short film this summer. And so we're currently casting in Montana. We're there are chances helping assemble a crew there. And we're kind of taking our short film script and we're, breaking it down by scene and what we need for the location, what we need for props, what we need for wardrobe. And we're in that process now of planning all the stuff before we actually get on set to shoot in the late June.
Excellent. And is Colton going to be taking a part in the film itself? I saw he has a Netflix series of his whole coming out process as well. What do you see his involvement moving forward?
No, he's more behind the scenes, just as an executive producer on the project. And, but he'll be on set with us, just helping out behind the scenes.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah,
and
he can be on set.
In the casting process, have you narrowed down the two lead parts at all, or are you still looking?
We we're not going to reveal that kind of stuff right now. We are really happy with where it's moving forward. And I think things will be revealed soon, but we're really excited with the casting process and who we're talking with. But yes, we're going to wait a little longer for that. So it's not done yet.
Excellent. Well, guys, we're down to our last 5 minutes. So what haven't I asked you that we should be talking about around this?
I have a fun little tidbit that we could talk about. So, Rob, you're a huge fan of food. So, one of the small things I got to bring to Ryan's wonderful story within the Scraps is we have a lot of great food scenes. So like one of our characters is Uncle Dan. One of our characters is Uncle Dan, and he's like a wonderful kind of elderly stoic lumberjack with a heart of gold character. And one of the ways that Uncle Dan shows love is through cooking. You know, he used to cook for his wife, who unfortunately passed away. And now that Gus is coming into town to spend time with him, Uncle Dan's journey is that he's been pretty lonely for many years. And, you know, once Gus comes around, he realizes, oh, I have family that I can kind of share stuff with again. And so Uncle Dan cooks for Gus, and we'll have some beautiful food in the film. And then the boys bond over, like, in there's, like, a burger shop. It's kind of iconic in Livingston, Montana. And we have, like, the boys enjoying, like, pizza burgers and ice cream cones and malt. And then there's, like, a particular scene that's one of my favorites that's in both the short and in the feature. And we call it the ketchup scene, which, you know, I don't know if I should tell you or not, but it's called the ketchup scene. And I'm very proud of that. So those are a little fun tidbits that I think you would probably enjoy, Rob.
Oh, yeah, I definitely will. It's like those films that are based around cooking, like the ones where the romance is, you know, between chefs and all that. I literally, pardon the expression, eat all that up. in the last 3 minutes, I do have a bizarre off-the-wall question, and this is for Ryan. In your bio, you do describe yourself as being an avalanche survivor. What was that about?
Yeah, that's actually true. I actually have a tattoo on my body from on my hand. It's a little reminder of that experience. But yeah, in Montana, kind of the first year that I was there, I had a lot of things thrown at me right away, and a couple of those things being an avalanche that I survived when I was backcountry skiing. It was a very serious, like full burial situation. I was charged by a grizzly bear and in a triple rollover car crash, you know, in a blizzard. And so Montana is a very serious place. I learned quickly. avalanche was a whole long story that could be told. But
I was going to say, you have an experience with drama that I'm sure will fuel this and many stories to come. It's like
I'll definitely say that has influenced a lot of my future scripts and log lines that I've got in the works. Is a lot of those, my time in Montana definitely influenced me, and also just time outdoors and backpacking. And I had thru-hiked the Continental Divide Trail with my mom. And so I've lived a lot of life for a 24-year-old, I will say, and
great.
Trying to get that to all of my writing.
Well, thank you guys both for coming on today. It's been a joy, and can't wait to see how this moves forward. Please keep us involved in that so we can talk about it and write about it in The Blade. And, you know, it sounds like it's going to be absolutely excellent. So I want to thank you guys for coming on today and excited to see the film. I want to thank Brody Levesque for his contribution to the show, as well as being the editor of the Los Angeles Blade. Make sure you read The Blade. It is your daily influx of original journalism, and it is the winner of the 2023 GLAAD Award for Excellence in Journalism, thanks to the work of Brody Levesque and his team. And you can find that at losangelesblade.com. As for us at Radio LGBT Radio, we will be back again next week with another really wonderful and exciting show. No idea what it is, but it will be all of that. We'll see you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!